Welcome to episode 148 of the OmniGamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including carnival games. I am Daniel Winter.
And my name is Mark Uessa. Hello, Daniel. How's it going?
Good, good. For those who missed it, we did take a week off here. So, lots to catch up on over these last couple of weeks. It's been very busy. It is the season for end-of-year school recitals and various wrap-ups going on here. So, yeah, keeping busy.
It's true. The summer season is nearly upon us, it feels like, and that's only going to be busier in a different way.
Absolutely.
All right. So, let's jump into it. We have three segments typically on the show. We have a short appetizer segment. We have our main course, which is usually delving a little bit deeper into one or more games that we played. And then a brief appetizer dessert, I should say, as well. A little off-topic topic to close us off. So, Daniel, do you have anything interesting for us?
Yeah, well, I guess speaking of carnival games there, I'll be throwing to the main later, where there's a game that we both discussed later for that might tie into that a little bit. But for the appetizer, in the meantime, I think I want to keep it a little simpler for now in terms of, I think our appetizer has been running a little long, and I've been feeling like I just haven't really had time to research news in great detail and have anything meaningful to say. So I think we'll be easing off the gas a little bit in that regards. But a couple of notes that I do want to bring to light. One good bit of news is that Greater Than Games is back to life. That is the board game publisher. Previously published games like Sentinels of the Multiverse and Spirit Islands had been acquired by Flat River Group in 2021, I want to say, and a few years ago, a couple of years ago, there was dropped from that following some consolidation over there, I guess. And they've been in limbo for the last couple of years, but they are officially back. Unfortunately, Spirit Island still in limbo right now, but the company is back under ownership of its co-founders, Paul Bender and Christopher Bedell, and they're focusing on both republishing Sentinels of the Multiverse and a couple of smaller new games they've got coming out. One based on Strongbad, I believe. Not a character I'm super familiar with, but I know nostalgic for many. So yeah, it's cool to see some creatives regaining some control and agency over the games that they created.
Nice. It's good to go back indie. A few others like Plat Hat Games have done it, so it's nice to see that direction.
I did see that there's a TTRPG, I think, based on the Sentinels of the Multiverse series, if people are interested in that. It's two or three different board games in the TTRPG, so it's a pretty wide IP now.
Very cool. Yeah, I am all for lightening up the appetizer segment. I think probably the longest ones have been kind of like when we go off on like philosophical tangents, and I'm the most guilty of that of anyone, so I'm totally fine to keep it light. And to that end, I just have a couple of stories that piqued my interest, and I didn't delve too deeply into them, but one of them is TTRPG related, since you mentioned. The project is called Memory Core, and this one aesthetically drew my attention. You know, we talked about cyberpunk, CBR, PNK the other day being an interesting format for TTRPGs, and this is no different. The concept is 1990s throwback to the PS1 era of console video games. This is a pack of multiple TTRPGs that all fit within basically two CD jewel cases. If you recall those ones, you know, made famous by Metal Gear Solid or Final Fantasy VII, basically every one of the, I think, five games in this set fit within one of those jewel cases. They take advantage of card-based character sheets and look very, very aesthetically fitting the mix of that 32-bit era video game that all the TTRPGs are inspired by. So I believe this project should be on BackerKit for at least a couple of weeks after we publish this episode.
I think it launches in a couple of weeks.
Oh, good. Okay. It was a couple of weeks for something, so I'm glad we got it.
There's a big lead up for these campaigns right now. Like, they have to, you know, set up the backers in advance and notifications and everything. It's a huge endeavor trying to getting the timelines established.
Right, and of course, us being retro video game fans and RPG fans, I couldn't fail to bring this up. It's by Horrible Guild, who are the makers of Wilder Feast, which was a campaign that did catch my eye the other day. I think I even backed it, that one. So, you know, they have their TTRPG chops as well. So that's Memory Core, the 1990s PS1 themed TTRPG set.
Yeah, I did take a quick look at that. It's definitely playing with those retro vibes, which might be also relevant to our main course a little later. But it's an era that I don't have a lot of nostalgia for, but I can definitely see the appeal, and especially with it's playing with sort of that plug and play aesthetic. I think there's six games in there that are all tying to some retro IP or sort of theme. But I believe the idea is that you can sort of mix and match and plug and play those modules into one larger setting. There's some cool ideas it's playing with. And it looks like there are board gamey, a lot of components and cards and sort of player aids in that sense, like packed into those little jewel cases there.
Yeah, I think it should really appeal to Omnigamers, not just because this is what our show is based on, but because it's like literal transmedia. It's TTRPGs for video game fans that has board game type qualities. So it couldn't be better suited to one willing to dip their toes into another medium or is already a fan of multiple of those. And yeah, as you alluded to and I mentioned as well, each of the games is based on a specific game. So you're going to see very much legally distinct, but based on an existing medium like Final Fantasy VII,
Castlevania, or Metal Gear Solid, yeah.
Symphony of the Night, which is another game we covered. So go check out the artwork for that Backer Kit project. You will get a real kick out of the artwork at very least.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, speaking of Kickstarter, well, crowdfunding, I guess, there's a couple of projects I wanted to highlight. There's a new endeavor coming up this month called Micro May, focusing on smaller games, as you can largely imagine. But a couple of particular projects that I was interested in, there's one called One Card Wonders. So this is created by a local designer, Jeremy Rosenhart, but also features some games by friends of the show, Noe Escobar, and a couple of other local designers, Sebastian Bernay Wong, who was also got a shout out in our recent Vancouver playtest episode. So this is basically a pack of 18 cards, each of which is a game. So 18 single card games. We've seen like the button shy wallets already sort of condensing those down. So 18 card games, but this is 18 games in 18 cards. So playing with a lot of real efficiency of design here, but a lot of different concepts in there. Got some skirmish games, race games, dexterity games, party games, a decent mix of different concepts and mechanics in there. So I thought it was just a fun experiment in elegance of game design.
Very nice. Yeah, I have tried my hand at designing 18 card games. It's a real challenge fitting all the design space you hope to see in a game within 18 cards. So I can't imagine how difficult it would have been to fit it in one. So that should be interesting, at least to see what they've done.
Yeah, it's a fun experiment at the very least. So I've backed that myself, I will say.
Very cool.
One more just quickly, also part of Micro May is called Soot and Charm. So this is by the publisher Graftbound Press, who previously published Bonds Between, a game that I backed, but still sitting on my TBR pile, but designed by Nathan Harris. And it's basically a TTRPG featuring sort of urban fantasy based in Boston, but it's playing with some sort of steampunk vibes, some sort of magic fairy vibes. So real mix of sort of magic and science in some fun ways. You can play similar to Wildsea that we've been playing, where you can play a sort of a living ship. In this, you can play a living train, a sort of sentient anthropomorphic train. The question remains, though, can you play as a train and suplex your enemies?
Very nice. Boston is a well-established setting for the Shadowrun TTRPG, so that's cool to hear about. It's a underutilized backdrop for games, especially TTRPGs. Okay, I have one more story that piqued my interest. Nothing to do with something to buy. It's a little profile about a undersung hero. The actual title of the story that I read on Polygon.com was "The Undersung Legend Who Made Zelda Weird." So that definitely caught my eye. The profile is essentially by a gentleman called Takashi Tezuka. who recently retired from game design from Nintendo, of course, where he spent 42 of his 65 short years, so that's the bulk of your life, at this legendary company and working on some legendary games indeed. Mr. Tezuka worked closely with, of course, more well-known luminaries like Miyamoto-san, especially in the early days, but, you know, went on to direct and produce plenty of other games that we're most familiar with. But perhaps his most impactful work for people of our age is a couple of Super Nintendo games that are, you know, considered masterpieces to this day. Games like Super Mario World and The Legend of Zelda: A Link to the Past. And basically, the article goes on to say that the kind of the apex of Mr. Tezuka's work was the kind of like oddball spirit and personality that he injected into a particular game that we covered fairly recently on the show called A Legend of Zelda: Link's Awakening on Game Boy from 1993. So I always thought, and we talked about how Link's Awakening is just a little strange, a little bit what Twin Peaks inspired, I think you yes. pointed out. And just has so much personality and so much charm, but is a little like different from the other Zelda games, which are a little bit more straight-laced at times. So basically, it's got his fingerprints all over it. So we'll share a link to this feature about Mr. Tezuka's life, but it's well worth a read because he touched so many games that are impactful to so many people.
Yeah, I mean, I've just played both of those older games recently. I've been thinking I really need to replay Super Mario World one of these days. It's been far too long. Yeah, I'm not particularly familiar with his design. I mean, he hasn't necessarily been in the limelight so much as Miyamoto and some of the other luminaries over there, but definitely had a huge impact behind the scene of the arc of Nintendo through the years there. I'm not sure what he's been working on recently. Link's Awakening was very playful in that sense of almost like a parody of Zelda games, and willing to be a little, inject a little levity, but still have that heartfelt sincerity to the game as well. So really fascinating balance of tones there. So that's a fascinating experiment in design that he's injected.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact credits, but in the article it goes on and covers quite a lot of them. And I think he was actively working on many projects up until quite recently, like newer games. Like I think he worked on Princess Peach Showtime, which just came out a couple of years ago. So yeah, he's actively working there. And 42 years out of 65, that's a long time to be working at one company.
I mean, Nintendo does seem to have had a decent grappling of utilizing these legends of design to oversee the next generation of creators, rather than them just being directors indefinitely, but sort of hanging around more in a mentor type role for newer designers.
Yeah, and we talked recently about, you know, kind of like they're all games now are designed by people that grew up playing games. And it's interesting to think about individuals like Mr. Miyamoto and Mr. Tezuka, who weren't video game designers by trade before they had to start video game designing. I think Tezuka was a graphic designer, and he basically like had to learn on the job everything about producing and directing video games, just, you know, right in the moment, right in the thick of it, because of course all of these video game companies in those early days were just bootstrapping everything. So incredible that legacy of those days is so strong, and that they were able to achieve so much in those early days before anyone knew what the rules were for this whole industry.
Yeah, and great to see that Nintendo has maintained so much of that institutional knowledge to pass along when we see so many studio closures and layoffs, that we've really lost a lot of that handover and legacy being passed along within the Western studios. So Nintendo has really retained a strong sense of that.
Yeah, one of the only few places that are. That about covers it for me for Appetizer. What about yourself, Daniel?
There was one other quick project I wanted to shout out. This wasn't part of Micromay, but is part of is from a local designer called A Die in the Dungeon by Rumiz Games, designed by Amir Salamati. So I spoke to Amir at TCTC. I didn't get a chance to demo the game, but I did have a quick chat to him about it and it looked quite interesting. This is based on a video game, a roguelite dice thrower. So it's like a bag builder type thing with you're building pools of dice and using these cards or sort of tiles to customize how those dice work. Basically, you've got multiple colors, you're throwing handfuls of dice of different colors and then customizing what each color of dice does essentially. So really cute art and interesting design there, that again playing with the elegance of sort of roguelike mechanics that are sort of ripe for board game implementation, I think, and the elegance of design. He previously designed the Children of Morta board game adaptation, which I really enjoyed that video game. And I've been quite curious to check out the board game version. Haven't quite gotten around to that yet.
Very cool. Yeah, that name definitely sounds familiar. Die in a Dungeon. I must have seen the video game you said it's based on.
Yes, yeah.
Featured on Steam.
That campaign is starting up this coming week, I think, when you hear this podcast.
Really cool. All right, Daniel, what do you think? Should we roll into our main topic?
Yes, lots to discuss in the main course of what we've been playing. Obviously we skipped last week, and I think part of that is just that I've been in a bit of denial as to my reduced time that I have for playing games and dabbling a little too much in my fingers in too many pies, shall we say. So I've been trying to focus a little more, and I think we want to also like try and cross-reference the games we were playing a little more and have a discuss games that we've both played and at least have a point of reference for.
Yeah, I think every season is going to change depending on where we are at individually and where we're both at. Yeah, obviously your lifestyle, work life change is a factor there. Although I think you were playing a little too many games, outpacing me by a great deal, tackling all those big items from my personal years-long backlog, just knocking them down like a bunch of trees with a chainsaw. So I was a little bit jealous there. But yeah, it's good to coordinate. And I've been playing a scattering of games, mostly games that I'd started before, because, you know, sometimes you just want to keep playing the games that you were playing. So I'm definitely going to have a smaller new game, actually an unreleased game to cover for one of my segments. And then I think you have a couple of smaller games yourself, and then we'll probably touch upon one game that you and I both played.
Yeah, that's true. I think we'll get to first, but I did also just want to quickly highlight that obviously, if you've been listening, you've probably noticed that we haven't been discussing many board games lately, which not for lack of wanting, it's just been really hard to schedule lately. Various friends of mine that I would normally game with have been on holiday, have had kids, and so it's just been particularly hard to schedule. I do have one that I'll try and talk about later today, but we do want to get back to that. We are still playing TTRPGs. We've got another session of Wildsea coming up this week, and I'm not sure that I'm ready to have a full discussion of that, but I think maybe after this next session, we should at least have an introductory talk and maybe like check in on that every now and then, rather than waiting till the perfect time, because that's never going to happen.
Yeah, I've definitely had my share of TTRPGs this season, which I'm happy to say it's usually not the case. But I recently finished my campaign, my little campaign of Eat the Reich, which we've mentioned a couple times. I think, what is his name? Howitt?
Grant
Howitt, that's his name. We mentioned a couple times for the, I think it was the one-page RPGs project you mentioned the other day. I also played Lasers and Feelings in the past. There's the book right there. So I did finish my little mini campaign of that. It took us like 5 sessions or something. So I will definitely have opinions to share. Not this episode, though. So look out for that in the future.
Excellent. So shall we jump to the one game that we've both played first and see how long we ramble on there for?
Yeah, that sounds fair. Let's do it. Okay, so I guess we'll both talk. The game we're talking about in question is on multiple platforms, I think, but I played it on Nintendo Switch. It's 2024 game Crow Country by SFB Games. And I see you left a little note there that they're involved in, or maybe did Snipper Clips before on the Switch?
That's probably their best known game, I think. They have a couple of other mobile games. There was a point and click mystery they did on Apple Arcade, I think it was. I don't recall the name of that.
Okay, very cool. The most distinctive thing about this game, even before you start it up, is its distinctive PS1 era graphics, and then its interesting art style comes in after that. But you cannot talk about this game, Crow Country, without talking about maybe the genre it comes from and the games that inspired it. I think whether this falls within those categories itself or not, you gotta say that this game kind of apes qualities from certain distinctive source material, like those PS1 era survival horror games, especially Resident Evil.
Yeah, I've not played Silent Hill. I'm not sure how much scripting from that specifically. I know those two series are very much in conversation with each other, but it reads very much like Resident Evil to me.
Yeah, I played the original Silent Hill back in the day, and I can't say much about it except it's very foggy. You don't see a lot, and it's a lot more atmospheric because of the fog also, and psychological. There's a lot of like kind of dream space. Is this really happening in reality sort of stuff happening in Silent Hill, as I recall it? Very different to Resident Evil, which is kind of like pulpy action movie a lot of the times. Like, the stuff that you're seeing is definitely happening in front of you.
I do think this plays with a little bit of that ambiguity, and I think that's part of the strength of this art style. We've seen like a huge range of nostalgia developments across 16-bit and 32-bit games, the pixel art video games essentially. It hasn't been quite as big a sort of focus on the PS1, like 64-bit, I guess you'd call it. There hasn't been quite as many games made with that style. I think it does sort of tend towards certain types of games. I think horror is definitely one of those that really takes advantage of those. And again, with those sort of low detail textures and graphics, it really does play into the sort of ambiguity of not quite sure what you're looking at between fog and sort of very lumpy plasticine models. Like, what exactly is that? Is that an enemy? Is that just a decoration? What is going on here?
Yeah, plasticine is exactly the word I was going to use to describe kind of the art style, because the graphical presentation and the art style are not exactly the same thing. You mentioned low poly, and this game is like humorously low poly, like even lower than like a Final Fantasy VII. Probably Cloud Strife's hair is made up of more polygons than the main character of this game is. Basically, the main character is just like a sphere with like a dress on.
It looks like an ice cream cone of your dress.
Yeah, and all the other characters are really kind of cutesy too. Actually, this game has a surprisingly adorable art style, character design for such a dark themed game. There are literal horrors. There are inhuman monsters, creepy crawlies all over kind of deformed things that are quite literally there and chasing you. And this game is set within a very delightful kind of like theme park setting, which I think is fantastic. The original Resident Evil, of course, had the iconic mansion, and the second game had the iconic police station, which sort of stood in for the mansion kind of environment. And this game does equally well, I think, with setting up a very personality-filled environment of this theme park, which is admittedly not that large. It's got about like four kind of main zones, whereas like a real world Disneyland might have six or seven larger zones. This one is quite compact.
I'd be disappointed paying money to go to this theme park. It's not huge.
Sure, but it did have the new section, the new zone that it was promising to come out in 1990.
DLC coming soon, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. So this game really starts out smart. Like, it has an intro where you're driving in this super low poly cardboard car cutout and driving up to this abandoned amusement park. It's all chained up, and you got to break your way in and solve the mystery and rescue the people that are in there, because there are some other characters as well.
Just to double down on that setting there, I think I do think it's an inspired choice using that theme park. I mean, as someone who watches a lot of Dead Mall videos, I think it has a very similar vibe of this sort of haunted location where you can see the echoes of where people used to be, and there used to be a lot of people here having fun, and contrasting that to the horrors, both the simulated horrors within the theme park itself, because there is like an undead zone, like a haunted house area, and the actual real horrors, obviously. So it's playing with a sort of simulated horror on multiple levels, I think, in some fun ways. And yeah. I believe it's also set in the 90s in the game. Early 90s, I believe, is when the game is set.
Yeah, that's right. I think like the events happen over the course of a number of years, and then there's these written press releases, posters, artifacts, this and that, of course, that you run into that you will unravel the story. And the story is actually fairly involved for such a brief game, and I thought was full of personality and told pretty well over the course of the game. Of course, these sorts of games always have to have a kind of like an overarching kind of reasoning why this outbreak, the weird undead or the weird creatures are happening. And this game does that, reveals that in a fairly creepy way, and does it well without getting in the way of the action. So let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of this game. It's a kind of a three-quarter perspective, fully 3D game. You don't have full control of the camera except to swivel and rotate, but you can't, you know, go over the shoulder and behind and through the eyes.
Sort of isometric view, sort of diagonal.
Yeah, that's right. But unlike those PS1 games, you actually have full control to go all the way around the character, which is something that you certainly couldn't do in the original Resident Evil. For that reason, though, the map, individual map spaces are separated out into kind of like well-divided rooms, with, you know, kind of gates blocking the passage between them, which totally makes sense. But as a result, the environments are fairly compact. And I actually think that's not a bad thing. I think that's a good thing. It really served to keep the space, the environment, well, easily trackable inside the person's mind. And you gain access to map segments fairly frequently. So you could easily track, like, oh, where did I see that thing again? You know, you don't even have to look at the map. It's already in your mind's eye, and you can easily kind of create the connections between the different zones. And funny enough, I didn't realize this until after I'd finished the game, but the Nintendo Switch cartridge that the game came in, courtesy of the Vancouver Public Library, had a fold-out, full-color map of the theme park.
Oh, I don't think I opened that. I also had a copy from the library. I don't think I bothered opening. Okay,
oh, cute. It was a real delight to see that. So one side was a fold-out, of course, of the fold-out sheet, was a poster for The Space World Coming Soon, 1990, which was fantastic. Okay. And the other side was a fold-out map of the theme park, of course, fully functioning, colorful and bright and non-threatening, which was great to see. It didn't really serve to help you navigate the levels per se, except to get a nice kind of thematic feel, like this is the underwater zone or whatever. And the box also featured a literal paper manual, which had profiles of the characters, had control, mapped out controls, it had tips and tricks, and it had a page where you can jot down your personal notes.
Well, there's a throwback we definitely need more of.
Absolutely. It really warmed my heart that they went to that effort. I mean, you know, I would, if I hadn't beaten the game already, I would definitely consider owning a copy to have something like that classic box contents. I think it's great.
Yeah, the map in the game, like there is a map you can just look at in your menu, but it's also like diegetic maps that you can find to sort of gradually fill in more detail. And because you are crisscrossing back and forth, doubling back through areas, almost a bit like a Metroidvania, which is a bit of a flavor of the year on the podcast, but you do really have a good sense of visualizing this space and internalizing your surroundings. I do get a little confused. Like my one pet peeve is that even though you can rotate the camera, whenever you go into a new area, it resets and have to like reorient myself and like which way am I facing again now. I wish it like remembered what direction you were facing, but other than that, I think it's a pretty good job of situating yourself in this space with these really beautiful, like really detailed dioramas of each room. And, like, there's so much detail to there, you often don't know what you're looking at. Like, it'd be halfway through the game and realize that there were these bottles lying around that, oh, technically there are actually things in those bottles that I could be shooting. I didn't realize what they were, or I've just been walking past health pickups this entire time, and sort of recontextualizes things as you gradually learn what you're looking at.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the environment is the mystery of what's going on, creates that environment of unease and uncertainty in survival horror games. And this one does ape that style very well. Now, it does give you a difficulty selector at the beginning of the game. I think one option was like kind of like no threat at all. It was just let you focus on the puzzles. I think there was the medium mode was kind of like the survival horror mode where there was threats around every corner. And then there was a more kind of hardcore mode that I presume amped up the difficulty quite a degree. I felt like the medium mode, which I played, which promised full survival horror, was not too difficult. This game is surprisingly generous with its amount of ammo and health packs and gear that it provides, to the point where I almost never had to worry about having ammo or health packs. If I ended up using them, which you do have to use, you do get knocked, banged here or there. Things drop on your heads unexpectedly. You get sprayed by poison gas or something like that. Definitely there are threats everywhere, but just around the corner, there are plenty of pickups of healing packs to replenish your supply. So I didn't really feel that sense of horror, of survival. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I have a feeling that they were utilizing a sort of dynamic system in populating the world with ammo and health pickups. Like the you won't start finding ammo until you get low. And like the more you have, the less you'll find, essentially. So I feel like you can start to see the code a little bit there sometimes in terms of gaming the system. But I think you can sort of turn your brain off in that regard and just enjoy the flow of it. I would have liked a little more friction personally, because it says at one point early on that you're going to have to prioritize, like, what enemies can you afford to run past and which ones do you want to take out? Because when you're doubling back through these spaces, and enemies will regularly repopulate. After certain triggers that you hit in the story will cause different enemies to appear. And do you have enough ammo to take them out, or will you just run past? I on one hand, I always had enough ammo to just shoot whatever I wanted to, but also it was incredibly easy to just run past everything. It wasn't necessarily always worth it to take the time to take everything out. So again, I would have liked a little more friction enforcing me into that decision, I think. Maybe if you'd moved a little slower or that ammo was a little tighter. I am curious to see how that hard mode is. I think that was added after the fact. It wasn't in the original game. I want to get sweaty about this, but I think part of the appeal of these is to have that friction and feel the tension of the survival elements.
Yeah, I definitely felt the lack of survival horror there. But that said, you know, there is that added difficulty mode. And, you know, I did finish this game. I believe you did as well. And there is, you know, this is not a spoiler to say that there is a kind of a new game plus, which increases some of the challenge or adds new challenge, as I'm been led to believe. I have not played it myself, so I don't know. That said, I don't think the survival is the priority with this. Mm. And player, you choose for yourself how much you want to conserve your ammo. I found that for myself, I usually ran past the tough guys and I ended up shooting the small guys, because the small guys were greater impediments to my mobility. And individual pistol bullets are like a very small, low value commodity in this game. So much so that you can always go back to your car in the parking lot and load up at least one clip of bullets. So that's a feature that's always available to you. And you have to use bullets to break those aforementioned glass bottles on the ground. You have to use bullets to interact with, ironically, with many things in the world.
There's no like knife that you can default to if you run out of ammo. But I am curious about the easy mode as well, which you I don't think you have to fight enemies at all, because there is actually a story justification. There's a comment late in the game for why you wouldn't be attacked. And I think so that could play into the narrative quite easily, I think, and just make it a more sort of atmospheric puzzle adventure game rather than that survival element. So I think it could work both ways, but that middle default difficulty is sort of just going through the motions of the combat a little bit sometimes.
So here's my premise, and I hope it's not giving away too much, because I'm not going to say anything about the story. But I don't think that this is a survival horror game. I think this is a survival horror themed puzzle game, puzzle exploration game. I think this is a send-up. This is basically a tribute to an era of certain PS1 era puzzle adventure exploration games, non-linear exploration games. So the type of game we've been covering a lot. But this is like literally just an exploration game, and there are puzzles abound. Most of them are quite simple or of the variety that you've seen countless times before. There's the piano puzzle. There's the go find the switch or the hand crank. There's the, you know, go find this or that. Here's the crystal eye or whatever. All of those are there. They're just sort of kind of remixed in a new fashion. And a couple of the puzzles I thought were a little bit clever, but most of them were very much of the variety you've seen before.
Yeah, they at the very least, they do feel diegetic, being like part of the theme park. Like they don't just feel like these arbitrary, really out there reasons for like why crystal balls are used to unlock doors in a mansion, right? In Resident Evil, some of those puzzles always feel a bit out there. They feel a little more sensical in a theme park context as part of these sort of diegetic games and curiosities, I guess. So those are fun, the way the mini games are incorporated into that setting. Here, none of them are particularly challenging. There was a couple that I missed, like the clue, basically. There's one with soda. You have to like do soda in the right order. And I was able to brute force that. Like I guessed it, got it right. Like, oh, I guess I was overthinking that. I completely missed what the clue was. Yeah. And there were others that I like were just easier than I was expecting. And just like, there was one we had to do some math basically, and was a little easier than I was expecting, and just I accidentally happened to solve it by happenstance.
Yeah, that's right. None of the puzzles were that difficult, and this game goes to exceeding lengths to give you clues. Basically, I mentioned all those kind of newspaper articles or whatever sitting around. Well, there's kind of like two kinds of things you can find is these like newspaper clippings and then these video game magazine clippings.
Oh, yeah, like the guy at the tips section of the
game. Yeah, exactly. Like the GamePro tips clippings or whatever. And that was super cute because those, the latter were basically just like guides as to how you play this video game. Whereas the news bits and clippings, newspaper clippings, were how to solve puzzles that you need to unravel for the game. And I should distinguish that there's two types of puzzles. There's story puzzles, and then there's optional surprise. I think they're called surprises puzzles. Mm. And then there's 15 optional surprises in the game, and they're numbered. You see them off.
Because you do get like a report at the end of the game, like showing you, giving you a rating out of like from A, B, C, and I think I got 8 of the 15 secrets, and I thought I was being pretty thorough with searching through everywhere.
Yeah, I got all 15 secrets. Oh, wow. Okay. Just because I had to. It's a relatively short game as well, but I think I ended up getting an A rating in it. Even though I didn't like do it so optimally, it's just, you know, it's not that hard. But yeah, so some of those optional ones, they're optional. You don't have to do them, but they will give you significant upgrades. Some, well, half of them are just like ammo. And then the other half are like literal upgrades to the weapons that you have or new weapons that you don't usually get. So they are worth it, but also not terribly necessary.
The game isn't long enough to really need a magnum that's going to, you know, it's not going to last you very long, basically.
Yeah, I mean, you might use it in one battle or whatever. So those are nice that they're there, but you don't have to do them. So yeah, I think this game is just about puzzles, just about exploration, and it's about kind of vibes. Like, you're going to feel reminded of those experiences you had playing those early Resident Evil games, other survival horror games. And if you didn't play those games, this is kind of like a primer for them. You know, this is like a Fisher-Price My First Survival Horror Game. Because that horror element is not there. And because that survival element is definitely very, very lenient, you don't feel too taxed at any time. You definitely don't feel scared. I didn't feel scared at all playing this game, and I'm not really good with horror. I thought it was cute. Everything is just so cute. The writing is kind of humorous as well. I don't know. What did you think about the aesthetics or the atmosphere?
Yeah, well, just to double back into the puzzles, like I do think those were not particularly... You never had to stretch your brain a huge amount, but it was a very satisfying, like, brain training exercises, essentially, like, especially the way they're incorporated into this setting. So I think that those were, as part of the bigger puzzle, I think those worked together quite well. There's diegetic moments bringing you into this world. I think that they were all incorporated quite well. So the story was all sort of scattered around piecemeal, and so that very archaeological form of like trying to fit the story together as you're exploring and gradually piecing everything together what's happening. And I do think the story is brought together in a really satisfying way. I won't spoil anything. There is, as you can imagine, some twists and turns that I didn't see coming. I think a lot of people probably could. I'm sort of like, when I'm enjoying something, I'll just be part of the moment and go along for the ride and let it deliver those twists to me, right? And I thought everything came together in this really satisfying way, but at the same time, like, being quite ambiguous. And like I said, rather than leaning into that melodrama of Resident Evil, it's a slightly sort of, it's quirky, but it has that sort of more Lovecraftian sort of undertone of sort of deeper dread going on, rather than just the science experiment zombies of Resident Evil.
Right.
Pulpy horror.
I agree. I was satisfied with the story of this game, and it's short but sweet, and I sort of bought into it. Like, the amount of setup and suspense and pressure and mystery was, I thought, well earned. It wasn't too deep. You always knew that there was this sort of like Howard Hughes kind of like eccentric millionaire or whatever that set up the amusement park. You know that from early on, from all the writings about him and this or that. So, of course, he's a central character, and it does explain why there are these kind of horrific creatures throughout in a satisfying way. And it comes to a close where you get to hang out with some of those characters that you rescued along the way or met. And I think even the side characters are kind of delightful, too. Mm. They're not around for that long, but they are utilized effectively, I think.
I do like how you keep running into various characters around the world, and like they'll move around the theme park as you're triggering certain things. It's always fun to just see this ensemble and again part of start fitting together this bigger piece of the puzzle. I thought that was quite satisfying with that little crew of misfits.
Yeah, I think they utilize the characters well. I mean, we talked the other day about Metroid games and kind of Metroid 4. Prime 4 seeming to break the mold of this kind of the solitary exploration of the main character by having these chatty characters that are squawking into your ear the whole time. This game doesn't do that. You only see the characters in very distinct spots. They never chatter in your ear. They never tell you what to do. You might get a hint or two here or there, and you'll run into them at very specific points, but it doesn't get in the way of your exploration. And I think it's just the right amount of story to balance kind of the light theme and the light puzzles of this pretty satisfying game, I think.
Yeah, in most regards, it's just enough. It doesn't overstay its welcome. Like, I mean, even something like Resident Evil 2 had that really tight mana sequence, that really dense space that you're returning through and doubling back and unlocking, and then it sort of, once you're done with that, it just sort of keeps going and like jumps the shark a little bit, whereas this has this core experience and it's done. And I think it's just enough. It's not really doing much new, but it's just enough of everything in a very confident little package.
I agree. Yeah, I think if you're comparing this literally to a Resident Evil, most of the early Resident Evil games are about 2 to 3, maybe even 4 times the size of this game. This is just in exploring one space in a very kind of circular and satisfying and thorough way. And it feels cohesive and whole without going too deep. And I honestly think this is a well-intentioned send-up to the genre and the format. And it's not trying to be one of those. It's trying to remind you of and honor those games.
Sorry.
How long do you think this game was, or how long did it take you to play?
5 hours, maybe.
Yeah, about something like that. Yeah. This won't, I'd be surprised me if it took you 6 or 7 hours to beat this game, maybe to do 100% of those side objectives. Yeah. Okay. So I think people probably understand, you know, I recommend this game. I think it's really, really enjoyable, cute, and just right. I liked it as a kind of a bite-size nod to those survival horror games that I can't always get into myself because they seem to be a little bit too long and a little bit too scary for my taste a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's definitely not reinventing the genre, but it's remixing it in a way that I found quite satisfying. And again, a story, I think, that brought a tone down. It was a really interesting mix of sort of more cosmic horror. Although there was a note at the very end that I missed that kind of explains everything that's happening in a way that I kind of, like, I prefer not knowing what exactly was happening, to be honest.
Yeah, I guess that's actually kind of a good thing because the newspaper clippings, they'll tell you this is like clipping 4 out of 57 or something like that. So you definitely know when you're missing things. And maybe that's part of the mystery as well that you feel like you're unraveling because the characters will talk about cryptic things as well. And not everything is spelled out so clearly. And I hope that the developers and publishers do explore the space a little bit more. I don't know if you could literally do a follow-up to this, but I like the style, let me just say.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm curious to see what they do next.
All right, shall we talk about more games?
Yeah, a couple of smaller ones I think we've got time to get to, if you want to do one each, perhaps.
Sure. Do you want to start us off, or should I?
Yeah, I mean, just to mix it up and throw in some tabletop games. I've got a board game that I've played, if I can find my notes here. So a little card game that I've played called Tether, also from 2024. This is designed by Mark McGee, artist Eric Kibler, and published by How to Steam Broccoli. So this is a little small box card game, single deck of cards. Looks very similar to, it's reminiscent of games like The Mind or The Game. It's basically just a deck of cards numbered 1 to 100, essentially, which you might think has limited design space for what you might do with that. But this has some quite clever innovations. For one thing, I think there's only like 50 cards because every card is mirrored. So one card will say 36, but the bottom of the card will say 63. And so you're playing in such a way that you'll see one number, but your opponent, because it's a two-player or team-based game, you'll see one number and your opponent will see the mirrored number. I think you're supposed to be sitting sort of opposite each other, and so you can only ever count the number that you're seeing oriented in your direction. So what you're trying to form chains and tether cards together in like sequential numbers. The trick is that you're playing, or one of you will be playing cards vertically, and I'll be laying cards up and down. But your opponent will be trying to lay cards horizontally, left to right. And so you're playing into this grid or like this sequence. You have like multiple battlefields across the table. Like you can add on to existing groups or create new groups and then tether them together later on. And so there's this real sort of shifting battlefield as the game goes on. So it reminds me of something like, Tigris and Euphrates and some of those sort of classic Runner-Knizia games that sort of, the shifting battlefield is always very satisfying. But this is just numbered cards, essentially, with some beautiful artwork. And it's a surprisingly amount of strategy that we've started to eke out of this in terms of the timing and when you're putting cards down and what information you're revealing. Because like every card you put down, say you're playing cards in your row horizontally, every card you put down is creating more opportunities for your opponent to play on to vertically. So you really want to time how many opportunities you're giving them, because you only score the cards at certain thresholds. When a group hits 6 or 10 cards, you'll score based on how wide or how tall that group is. And so you want to be really careful in how to time and not give opportunities to your opponent. So, and a bit of card counting, and there's a bit of luck in there as well. I mean, I can't expect any game of this size to last 100 games, but just enough that I'm really getting some enjoyment out of this.
Very cool. Sounds like it has a little slight elements of another two-player game like Lost Cities in there.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say, like, the I briefly mentioned the art, but it is this really beautiful sort of retro sci-fi, very cartoony art style that I really enjoy there as well. They play, it's, I mean, the rules, it's a couple of ambiguities in the rules I don't love. And there's an FAQ, except the FAQ is just jokes, basically. And, like, on one hand, that's not very useful. On the other hand, I did, like, guffaw out loud a couple of times. It is well, like, they're having a lot of fun with this game.
Very cool. All right, I am going to cover a totally different game, although it is a retro sci-fi, which you mentioned shortly. This time around, it's not a tabletop game, though it is a video game or a computer game. And it's, I would be say it's brand new, but it's not released yet, so it's not even that. It's going to be released soon. This difficult to pronounce game is called Particulitics. And we will share the spelling of it and the link to the Steam project shortly, but this was provided by developer publisher Workshop Geek. So thank you for providing that. Of course, no money changed hands, and we have not shared our opinion before publishing the episode. So what is this game? This game is a retro-inspired, kind of twin-stick shooter-inspired game. They call it themselves a arcade roguelite meets Geometry Wars style game.
Geometry Wars would be my main touchstone looking at something like this. Or some of the Housemark games, Sectori, one that came out recently. These sort of particle shooters, essentially.
Yeah, definitely particles are right there in the name and the aesthetic as well. And Housemark games aesthetically probably stand as a big inspiration for this title. So this is a kind of like single screen action roguelite. So my kind of touchstone of familiarity for that sort of game is something like Brotato. Might be familiar to you as well. Not at all aesthetically, but more gameplay wise. So, you know, it's got the typical roguelite things covered. You shoot a bunch of enemies and waves, and then they drop XP. You pick up the XP, and then you get some upgrades, and then you shoot some more. And so this game, I don't think it's going to win any awards on aesthetics or on graphic design. It's actually very rudimentary and fundamental. It's basically kind of geometric. Like, you control this little ship, what I call a ship avatar. I think it's just a little blob that shoots stuff. I don't even remember what it is.
Triangle, probably.
Yeah. There is no story to speak about. And the enemies are just different kind of geometric shapes.
You know what you're here for.
Yeah, exactly. Some of them are spherical. They look like little eyes. They chase you. Some of them are like these squares, and then they just go straight or horizontal or vertical, or they follow their own specific rules. So nothing too innovative there. The gameplay goes beyond that. You're spending a lot of time unlocking things. You start off with, I think, two different ship options to choose from, and they basically amount to like different weapon types. I think the first ones are, there's a sniper, what they call, which is a very powerful single straight shooter, and you can shoot, of course, in 360 degrees around you in any case, whatever weapon you choose. The second weapon is a three-shot spread, they call a shotgun, and then the last two are a little bit confusing. I think the third one is called like spiral something, and then the fourth one is this kind of like scattershot AK automatic weapon something something. Those are the options that I saw available to me. So kind of fairly limited, not as broad as something like the many character features in a game like, I think, 20 Minutes to Dawn, I mentioned before, as being a particularly fun action roguelite that I enjoy playing recently. So this game, what is it doing that's interesting? Well, it is doing a couple of things that are different. So unlike Vampire Survivors, or that aforementioned 20 Minutes to Dawn, when you kill an enemy in those games, typically the XP orbs kind of just drop where they lay, right? But this game is a little bit different. Actually, they succumb to gravity. So the XP kind of slowly drifts down the screen away from where they were shot. So if you shot someone at a distance, it's going to like kind of shuffle to the bottom of the screen, and you're going to have to kind of like change your position to grasp that XP and scoop it all up, so that you can upgrade weapons to increase your damage output, of course. So that part of it is there. And the other part of it that is actually, I think, innovative is that they have these sort of like bonus effect zones. So,
I was wondering about that. Yeah, I saw like, in the screenshots like these rectangular zones. Basically, I was curious what those add to the mechanics.
Yeah, they are. I was really confused at the beginning too because I felt like, what are these zones? Am I supposed to go into them? Am I supposed to avoid them? And you can freely go between them. And what I didn't realize is that these zones actually move. So they will stay positioned for a certain amount of time, maybe like a minute or two. And then on a fixed point, they will shift and move dramatically. Sometimes they're squares. Sometimes they're rectangles that will span the entire width of the map. Sometimes they will be literal quadrants of the single screen map. But they do radically shift a lot. And on exciting occasions, they even overlap. So what do they actually do? They're pretty easy to understand, and they're spelled right out on there. One of them is two times XP. So if you stand within the square, if you put your ship within the square, every XP orb you collect is doubled. Really great, obviously. There are 2 to 4 kind of damage bonus areas. So it's literally 2 times, 3 times, or 4 times. And then there's this one that like kind of ratchets up over time, but it decreases the more time you spend in there. So it's kind of a little bit of a give and take. There's another zone that's faster fire rate. And then there's another zone that's faster reload rate. So these initially, they don't seem to be that dramatic. But when you start to think about it, it really makes you kind of consider where you want to go within that simple 2D plane. So I already mentioned that the drifting, falling XP orbs fall towards the bottom of the screen. The enemies don't. They freely move around. And these bonus zones are shifting everywhere. So you are actually kind of pulled in a bunch of different directions. You do obviously want to keep moving at all times to avoid enemies that are homing in on you. But if you target a zone just right, kind of sneak between two groups of enemies that are chasing you from a couple of different vectors and land on a, you know, 4 times damage bonus area right when they're upon you and you blast them all away, that creates a kind of a satisfying synergy.
It's just one more factor to consider in trying to triage where you want to be any given time, I guess. And like,
yeah,
one more factor that sort of push and pull of trying to maximize your effects.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of these action roguelites will make you move when there's, say, an area where enemy damage will be increased or something like that. But there are not a lot of roguelites where you have these kind of positive general effects that are shifting around. So I think that's the kind of the special sauce to this game. And it is making this more enjoyable to play than I initially thought. I think I've told you before that shoot 'em ups, I have a love-hate relationship with them. I only like a very few of them. And some of them I like more than others. Thankfully, those Housemarque games are actually really kind of really good, smart forms of those shoot 'em up games. And I think this one kind of fits within that mode. At very least, I played upwards of, I think I played around 4 hours of this game over a couple of spans. And that is interesting because I already mentioned there's no story. The art is not that inspiring. The color palettes are actually kind of painful to the eyes. They're very, very garish. And some of the color palettes that you unlock, you know, they're kind of fun. Like some of them, like there's a Game Boy DMG inspired color palette, for instance, or a Pico 8 inspired color palette, or Commodore 64. So these will obviously be appealing to retro hardware fans, but you have to really pick and choose because some of them are actively going to work against you in being able to distinguish what is going on the screen. So some of those are not really winning factors, but something about the kind of give and take of the upgrades, the bonus zones, and of course the roguelite upgrades that are there. We cannot deny that that's a kind of addictive quality built into the design. And I haven't mentioned the upgrades mostly because they are mostly the typical ones that you see everywhere. But you're given basically like 3 to 6 upgrades that you can unlock at any given time. They start in a basic format, and then there's a little branching tree that you can choose to upgrade from a basic starting point. And I actually thought that that was a more interesting way that you could do this sort of upgrading thing than a game like a Ball Pit or a Vampire Survivors lets you do. Most of those are fairly linear. This one has a very simple branch. I don't know if branch is exactly what you would call it. It's more of like a diamond shape. It's like you start at a basic point, you branch out into two choices, and then you go back into one choice. But it gives you multiple of them. Some of them are somewhat clever. Like one of them is you have this kind of like accumulative explosion that you can pump kind of points into, and then it explodes, creating a damage blast around you to the enemies. And you can choose either that it explodes the more you hit an enemy, or it builds up the more you move your ship. So those are, you know, distinctive choices. And depending on the weapon you choose, you know, you can be quite strategic with how you use them. So I think there is some interesting play there. This game is worth playing a little bit to dig deeper into the bones of, but I think that's going to cap out eventually. I think most players will probably tire of the repeated play in about maybe 5 or 6 hours. But, you know, we on the OmniGamers podcast are not shy playing shorter games. I think more shorter good games are a welcome thing. So I don't know the price of this game, but I think if what I've described sounds appealing to you, you don't mind playing a 6-hour game, this game would be worth checking out.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken before how I'm not really a big fan of sort of these arcadey point chases, shoot 'em ups either. I recently did play Mini Shoot Adventures, which sort of recontextualized those mechanics into a more linear story-based Zelda-style game, and I quite enjoyed that. But I don't know, roguelikes I just also don't have a lot of time for these days. But obviously, there is a huge audience for these. If you're one of those sickos, I'm sure you're always looking for more of those options. I do have to say, I did see on the Steam page that they did disclose that there is AI music is used in the game, if that matters to you. You should all know how I feel about that. But yeah, just putting that information out there to everyone, make an informed choice.
Yeah, I did see that feature, and thankfully you can turn it off. Mm-hmm. And I did turn it off after I discovered that. And there's, you know, 2 or 3 kind of cute thematic retro tunes that belong there, but it becomes quite repetitive over time. So yeah, take that for what you will. I've basically covered it. This is not a revolutionary game, but you can get, you know, 5 or 6 fun hours out of it.
That's what you need sometimes.
Exactly. It's not a forever roguelike, which is a good thing in this day and age.
Excellent.
All right. Shall we move on from there?
Yeah, I think, should we jump to dessert, or is there anything else we should discuss?
Dessert
I can definitely
is fine
go longer if you want, but I mean, we talked about Zelda earlier. I just today wrapped up a replay of Ocarina of Time. That's maybe something we could discuss in a future episode.
I've been playing more Metroid Dread, so maybe we'll be revisiting some more non-linear exploration games. But let's save that to a future episode. Let's talk dessert. Would you like to go first, sir?
Why not? Sure. I watched a little movie called Speed Racer. So this came out in 2008 from the Wachowski sisters, based on the anime. I thought it was actually a Western animation. Apparently, it's actually an anime, I think, from like the 60s, I want to say. But I've been trying to watch this film for years. It crashed and burned upon release, but has been really had this revival of various reviewers I follow saying this is one of the best films ever made. Like, so I've been trying to track it down, and it's not streaming, or at least the one place it is streaming is only in French. It's not a library. You can't buy it. Like, the only place you can get it is Amazon for $30. All the other places are only selling like the upcoming 4K release for $50. But thankfully I checked the screenings at my sort of local independent theater, the Rio, and they happen to have a screening of the new 4K release of Speed Racer. I had to rearrange a few things. I had to take my 6-year-old daughter along as well, so pushing the boundaries of what's appropriate there. But suffice to say, I had an absolute blast. And so, I mean, a lot of the comments around this movie are basically saying that it was before its time. Like these, the Wachowskis are really tastemakers, reinventing the wheel before people are ready for it, basically. And like this, it's, I mean, you watch any scene from this film and it's immediately obvious that it's hyper real. It is utilizing CG not to make the fantastical look real and getting uncanny valley in the process, but to make the real look fantastical. Like the layering multiple like characters and elements so that everything is constantly in focus, or having these talking heads flashing back and forth across the screen, or like there's these whip pan, like two characters in different race cars talking to each other, and rather than having just camera cuts, it's whip panning back and forth with CG in between these two characters talking. Like it is one of the most like animated cartoon movies I've ever seen. It is like, it's very predictable. You know what's going to happen in at the end of the day, and who's going to win the final race. It's like the messaging is you've seen this before. It's very much, you know, like it's about him racing for his own joy and the love of the art and the that personal drive, rather than giving into sort of the capitalist manipulation of the sport and the artistry, which you can read metaphors in multiple ways. But it's all delivered in this very heartfelt, sincere way that's surprisingly rare these days. I mean, you've got this pretty stacked cast with John Goodman and Susan Sarandon as the parents. John Goodman, I mean, dressed as Mario for half of this film. So this is basically the Mario Kart film that we deserve. And yeah, I had a blast. It is a kid's film. My daughter had a blast too. It's got a monkey throwing poop at the bad guy. It's got ninjas with, you know, having their pants pulled down. You see their underpants. Like it's basically Spy Kids. And it's a very similar oeuvre there. So, and I had a blast. The kid had a blast. So yeah, really enjoyed Speed Racer. I mean, The finale of this film, like literally the sights and sound are turned it so up so high to beyond 11 that it literally breaks reality as like the it literally turns into a cartoon at the final moments. It's incredible.
That sounds awesome. I haven't seen this, but your description sounds very enticing. And I didn't watch the source material either, but it's kind of legendary for people my age. It's kind of like, the kind of catchword is like over the top, like it kind of invented over the top. So obviously they went to a fun place there.
I did actually watch a couple of episodes of the original. It's on Tubi, FYI. So my daughter seemed pretty engrossed with it, considering like it's pretty dated by today's standards. But, I think it's good to have. Good to introduce these old favorites to our kids. I mean, we grew up with the cartoons of our parents, Flintstones and Yogi Bear, and being well-versed in those that were still having movies released into the 90s.
That's right. Wacky Races, all yes. That sort of
Well, this does stuff. Touch on some Wacky Races, I think, yeah.
Very nice. All right, for a complete about turn, I'm going to talk about a more real gritty novel, let's just say, but, kind of maybe came out around the era that probably Speed Racer the film did. This is a novel called Invisible Dead. And I didn't really know much about this. And I found it profiled on Libby, which is, of course, the app I use to borrow ebooks and whatever from the library. I think it's all over the world, so most people probably are familiar with it. But because I was pulling from the VPL system, it featured local stuff. So this is basically a noir detective novel that is set in Vancouver, written by a local author. And this, like I said, the story takes place in maybe about 15 years ago. So maybe just kind of like turn of the 21st century, but up to 2010 sort of thing. It's kind of indistinct. People have cell phones, but they don't really have like social media is kind of like that era that I'm thinking there. They don't really have iPhones per se, or maybe some of the people do. So it is kind of a period piece even there. So this novel, I thought it was actually quite cheesy at first, but I think it's because it's really kind of trying to ape a lot of the kind of Sam Spade, like detective noir stuff. The main character is very, I wouldn't say stereotypical, but he's very kind of like single-minded and very much a curmudgeon and a non-conforming sort of character who constantly does whatever is the least easy option, essentially, let's just say. They're trying to solve the toughest impossible case in order to, like, not make any money and make their friends miserable, sort of thing. So, typical detective stuff. And it's, of course, that has a natural contrast to the modern day setting, because this isn't the turn of the 20th century. This is the turn of the 21st century. So the setting is different. And the author is trying to bake in every name drop restaurant and bar and park name in Vancouver.
Also, it's very much actual Vancouver.
100%. Not just one of those filmed in Vancouver, set in New York sort of things. It's literal. In Vancouver, I think maybe the guy had an office in a building where I actually had an office sort of thing in history. The opening scene is in Crab Park. Like, it's definitely set here. So if anyone has been to Vancouver or lives in Vancouver, it'll be a treat from that perspective. And I think that this novel, the author's by the name of Sam Weeb, by the way, and it's successful enough to have spawned an entire series. So there's multiple Detective Wakeland novels that are out there. This novel in particular, though, straddles some touchy subject matter. Let's just say, of course, it's a detective story. There's going to be murder and salacious matters involved there. Definitely a lot of violence, even some harming of animals here or there. So just be aware of that. But more important than that, this novel is about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, which is a very relevant, present, and real matter for certainly, you know, everyone that lives in Western Canada and probably all across North America. Missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls is a real thing. And this novel tackles that head on. It's entirely about it. And the main character is basically unapologetic, boneheaded kind of white guy. And unlike some of those other novels where I was saying that, I wasn't really appreciating their kind of one-dimensional perspective on non-white people, this novel actually handles a whole bunch of different types of people and people that you would typically see in Vancouver, Asian Canadians, First Nations, rich, poor, people who are addicted to substances. It covers kind of the whole range, trans people. So this seems very familiar and very, very kind of present and authentic, I guess, let's just say.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you want to see white authors approach some diversity and not just write what they know, but some of those issues require some more sensitivity than others, shall we say.
That's right. And it's all the more challenging because this is a slightly older novel, which was probably even more revolutionary when it came out that it was tackling that matter, because, like, this is a legacy of kind of shame that basically all Canadians have to reckon with, is the treatment of Indigenous First Nations individuals in general and missing and murdered women and girls in particular. So this novel tries to tackle that in a sensitive manner. I think, to my perspective, it does that fairly well. And it's really interesting because there's a character who's like an artist, like a visual artist in the story. And he is making bank off of exploiting, essentially, people that are down and out, Indigenous people that are in desperate situations, like the subject of the missing woman. Who the detective is trying to chase down. So I feel like the real world author, kind of wrote that character in to kind of give themselves a little bit of smokescreen. Is like, hey, I know I'm taking advantage of and exploiting this really sensitive topic.
You can absolutely write, like, deplorable characters. The question is, does the author know that they're deplorable?
Yeah, I think that character knows that they could be perceived that way. So they're trying to do a gentle balance. Speaking of gentle balance, this story shuffles from really kind of ironic, grumbling crank kind of character, basically like criticism of modern culture, to some really pulse pounding like action scenes. The last, maybe like the climax of the novel, is quite a thrill ride that they take you on. And there's a lot of violence, and it doesn't shy from that at all, which is actually really good, I think, because it it raises the stakes, essentially, for the character and for the story. And it actually involves quite a bit of humor, which you might think would not fit very well with that overall topic.
How do you balance all those things in one book?
It's very hard to balance, but I think they somehow managed to do it. They managed to thread that needle fairly well. There's this one particular chapter that's a kind of like a side story, all about a side jaunt that the main character takes into Winnipeg that's like kind of worth the price of entry on its own. And that's where a lot of the humor comes in. So this novel, what can you say? It's a terribly uneven novel. It takes you in a bunch of different places. It's a little bit cringy how much kind of like name dropping of Vancouver type stuff is going on, but I think some people appreciate it, and I did appreciate it.
Do you think anyone would get like much out of it if they're not from Vancouver and do the pointing at the book?
I think they will. I think the story is engrossing enough.
Okay.
I think the subject matter is important enough about missing and murdered Indigenous women, and also Vancouver is not the only place where this sort of tragedy happens, right? It happens in Washington State, it happens in Ontario, it happens in all sorts of places. So I, for one, think it's great to have a novel that's not set in New York or not set in LA or not set in Chicago that's of this kind of genre. And after a little break, I think I wouldn't mind picking up, you know, the next novel in this series. Like, the main character's interesting. He's not a perfect man, but he doesn't claim to be. And he makes some interesting decisions, and the side characters actually are well represented. There's a whole range of them. His unlikely girlfriend that he ends up forming a relationship, his mother, his business partner, Asian Canadian, some of the antagonists, some biker gang members, very interesting character portraits, and they feel kind of quite three-dimensional. So, overall, I think this novel is quite good. Invisible Dead by Sam Weeb, the first David Wakeland detective novel.
I was going to ask, this is the first in the series. I'm curious if this is one where you can just like jump into any book in the series and have it make sense.
Having only read the first, I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
But I think this is a great place to start. And obviously, you get to learn the character and his idiosyncrasies. And he's quite an idiosyncratic one at that.
Very good. I'm reminded of a game we covered very early in the podcast called Backbone.
Yes.
The sort of neo-noir raccoon detective set in fantasy Vancouver. But I think they actually changed the name of that. It was like Tales or something. The name changed at some point. I don't recall, but it was
Backbone. Yeah. And I also felt like that game wasn't really about Vancouver. Like, it just kind of like... It called
puns
it that.
Based on the name.
Yeah, and the backdrops were very much Vancouver-type places, but it didn't have to be set in Vancouver, and it went into some strange sci-fi places. So, yeah, this novel definitely does the name-dropping for you. You'll roll your eyes at a few of them, but it's cute in its own way.
Excellent. Well, if you have any questions or comments on today's games or other media, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. Go check out our videos of the episodes that we put up every time a new one goes out. Those are on YouTube. And if you want to check out our older episodes, the earliest ones are only in audio form. So go check those out on a podcatcher of your choosing. Please like and leave comments. Rate on either of those platforms that you use. We don't have ads or anything like that. We don't charge any subscriptions. So we do this for the love. Please share and maybe mention our show to someone in your life who might be interested.
If you have any horror fans who might enjoy Crow Country, please do pass it along. Always appreciated. And you can find us, or find me at least, on Blue Sky at Board Game Feast and the Omni Gamers Club account there as well.
Thanks so much for keeping the social media flame alive there, Daniel. I have still quit. I'm having a hard time. I feel like I'm missing out on things, but at the same time, I'm feeling more peace in my life. So that's good.
I'm feeling that pick at both ends.
Nice, nice. All right. Who knows what we'll cover in our next episode? Maybe it'll be a TTRPG. Maybe it'll be a board game in more depth. Lots of more fun stuff to cover.
Lots of options. And in the meantime, remember to have a balanced diet of games. Thanks for listening.
Cheers. Bye-bye.